Chapter 24. Luckily, there was a strong updraft in the alley because Arthur hadn't done this sort of thing for a while, at least not deliberately, and deliberately is exactly the way you are not meant to do it. He swung down sharply, nearly catching himself a nasty crack on the jaw with a doorstep, and tumbled through the air, so suddenly stunned with what a profoundly stupid thing he had just done, that he completely forgot the bit about hitting the ground, and didn't. A nice trick, he thought to himself, if you can do it. The ground was hanging menacingly above his head. He tried not to think about the ground, what an extraordinarily big thing it was, and how much it would hurt him if it decided to stop hanging there and suddenly fell on him. He tried to think nice thoughts about lemurs instead, which was exactly the right thing to do, because he couldn't at that moment remember precisely what a lemur was, if it was one of those things that sweep in great majestic herds across the plains of wherever it was, or if that was wildebeest. So it was a tricky kind of thing to think nice thoughts about without simply resorting to an icky sort of general well-disposedness towards things. And all this kept his mind well occupied while his body tried to adjust to the fact that it wasn't touching anything. A Mars bar wrapper fluttered down the alleyway. After a seeming moment of doubt and indecision, it eventually allowed the wind to ease it fluttering between him and the ground. Arthur? The ground was still hanging menacingly above his head, and he thought it was probably time to do something about that, such as fall away from it, which is what he did, slowly, very, very slowly. As he fell slowly, very, very slowly, he closed his eyes, carefully so as not to jolt anything. The feel of his eyes closing ran down his whole body. Once it had reached his feet, and the whole of his body was alerted to the fact that his eyes were now closed and was not panicked by it, he slowly, very, very slowly, revolved his body one way and his mind the other. That should sort the ground out. He could feel the air clear about him now, breezing around him quite cheerfully, untroubled by his being there, and slowly, very, very slowly, as from a deep and distant sleep, he opened his eyes. He had flown before, of course, flown many times on cricket, until all the bird talk had driven him scatty, but this was different. Here he was, on his own world, quietly and without fuss, beyond a slight trembling which could have been attributable to a number of things, being in the air. 10 or 15 feet below him was the hard tarmac, and a few yards off to the right, the yellow street lights of Upper Street. Luckily, the alleyway was dark, since the light, which was supposed to see it through the night, was on an ingenious time switch, which meant it came on just before lunchtime and went off again as the evening was beginning to draw in. He was therefore safely shrouded in a blanket of dark obscurity. He slowly, very, very slowly, lifted his head to Fenchurch, who was standing in silent, breathless amazement, silhouetted in her upstairs doorway. Her face was inches from his. "I was about to ask you," she said in a low, trembly voice, "what you were doing. But then I realized I could see what you were doing. You were flying. So it seemed," she went on after a slight wandering pause, "like a bit of a silly question." Arthur said, "Can you do it?"
"No."
"Would you like to try?" She bit her lip and shook her head, not so much to say no, but just in sheer bewilderment. She was shaking like a leaf.
"It's quite easy," urged Arthur, "if you don't know how. That's the important bit. Be not at all sure how you're doing it."
Just to demonstrate how easy it was, he floated away down the alleyway, fell upwards quite dramatically, and bobbed back down to her like a banknote on a breath of wind. "Ask me how I did that."
"How did you do that?"
"No idea, not a clue." She shrugged in bewilderment.
"So how can I?"
Arthur bobbed down a little lower and held out his hand.
"I want you to try," he said, "to step onto my hand, just one foot."
"What?
Try it."
Nervously, hesitantly, almost, she told herself, as if she was trying to step onto the hand of someone who was floating in front of her in midair, she stepped onto his hand.
"Now the other," he said.
"What?"
"Take the weight off your back foot."
"I can't."
"Try it."
"Like this?"
"Like that."
Nervously, hesitantly, almost, she told herself, as if She stopped telling herself what she was doing was like because she had a feeling she didn't altogether want to know. She fixed her eyes very, very firmly on the guttering of the roof of the decrepit warehouse opposite, which had been annoying her for weeks because it was clearly going to fall off, and she wondered if anyone was going to do anything about it or whether she ought to say something to somebody, and didn't think for a moment about the fact that she was standing on the hands of someone who wasn't standing on anything at all. "Now," said Arthur, "take your weight off your left foot." She thought that the warehouse belonged to the carpet company who had their offices round the corner, and took her weight off her left foot, so she should probably go and see them about the gutter. "Now," said Arthur, "take the weight off your right foot." "I can't. Try." She hadn't seen the guttering from quite this angle before, and it looked to her now as if, as well as the mud and gunge up there, there might also be a bird's nest. If she leaned forward just a little and took her weight off her right foot, she could probably see it more clearly. Arthur was alarmed to see that someone down in the alley was trying to steal her bicycle. He particularly didn't want to get involved in an argument at the moment and hoped that the guy would do it quietly and not look up. He had the quiet, shifty look of someone who habitually stole bicycles in alleys and habitually didn't expect to find their owners hovering several feet above them. He was relaxed by both these habits and went about his job with purpose and concentration, and when he found that the bike was unarguably bound by hoops of tungsten carbide to an iron bar embedded in concrete, he peacefully bent both its wheels and went on his way. Arthur let out a long-held breath. "See what a piece of eggshell I have found you," said Fenchurch in his ear. Chapter 25. Those who are regular followers of the doings of Arthur Dent may have received an impression of his character and habits which, while it includes the truth, and of course nothing but the truth, falls somewhat short in its composition of the whole truth in all its glorious aspects. And the reasons for this are obvious. Editing, selection, and the need to balance that which is interesting with that which is relevant, and cut out all the tedious happenstance. Like this, for instance. Arthur Dent went to bed. He went up the stairs, all 15 of them, opened the door, went into his room, took off his shoes and socks, and then all the rest of his clothes, one by one, and left them in a neatly crumpled heap on the floor. He put on his pyjamas, the blue ones with the stripe. He washed his face and hands, cleaned his teeth, went to the lavatory, realised that he'd once again got all this in the wrong order, had to wash his hands again, and went to bed. He read for 15 minutes, spending the first 10 minutes of that trying to work out where in the book he'd got to the previous night. Then he turned out the light, and within a minute or so was asleep. It was dark. He lay on his left side for a good hour. After that he moved restlessly in his sleep for a moment, and then turned over to sleep on his right side. Another hour after that his eyes flickered briefly, and he slightly scratched his nose, though there was still a good 20 minutes to go before he turned back onto his left side. And so he whiled the night away, sleeping. At 4 he got up and went to the lavatory again. He opened the door to the lavatory, and so on. It's guff. It doesn't advance the action. It makes for nice fat books, such as the American market thrives on, but it doesn't actually get you anywhere. You don't, in short, want to know. But there are other omissions as well, besides the teeth cleaning and trying to find fresh socks variety. And in some of these, people have often seemed inordinately interested. What, they want to know, about all the stuff off in the wings with Arthur and Trillian? Did that ever get anywhere? To which the answer is, of course, mind your own business. And what, they say, was he up to all those nights on the planet cricket? Just because the planet didn't have full on his fire dragons or dire straits doesn't mean to say that everyone just sat up every night reading. Or, to take a more specific example, what about the night after the committee meeting party on prehistoric Earth? When Arthur found himself sitting on a hillside, watching the moon rise over the softly burning trees, in company with a beautiful young girl called Mella, recently escaped from a lifetime of staring every morning at 100 nearly identical photographs of moodily lit tubes of toothpaste in the art department of an advertising agency on the planet Golgafrinchen. What then? What happened next? And the answer is, of course, that the book ended. The next one didn't resume the story till 5 years later, and you can claim some take discretion too far. "This Arthur Dent," comes the cry from the furthest reaches of the galaxy, and has even now been found inscribed on a mysterious deep space probe thought to originate from an alien galaxy at a distance too hideous to contemplate. What is he, man or mouse? Is he interested in nothing more than tea and the wider issues of life? Has he no spirit? Has he no passion? Does he not, to put it in a nutshell, fuck? Those who wish to know should read on. Others may wish to skip on to the last chapter, which is a good bit and has Marvin in it. Chapter 26. Arthur Dent allowed himself for an unworthy moment to think, as they drifted up, that he very much hoped that his friends who had always found him pleasant but dull, or more latterly odd but dull, were having a good time in the pub. But that was the last time for a while that he thought of them. They drifted up, spiralling slowly around each other, like sycamore seeds falling from sycamore trees in the autumn, except going the other way. And as they drifted up, their minds sang with the ecstatic knowledge that either what they were doing was completely and utterly and totally impossible, or that physics had a lot of catching up to do. Physics shook its head, and, looking the other way, concentrated on keeping the cars going along the Euston Road and out towards the Westway flyover, on keeping the streetlights lit, and on making sure that when somebody on Baker Street dropped a cheeseburger, it went splat upon the ground. Dwindling headily beneath them, the beaded strings of lights of London. London, Arthur had to keep reminding himself, not the strangely coloured fields of cricket on the remote fringes of the galaxy, lighted freckles of which faintly spanned the opening sky above them, but London, swayed, swaying, and turning, turned. "Try a swoop," he called to Fenchurch. "What?" Her voice seemed strangely clear but distant in all the vast, empty air. It was breathy and faint with disbelief. All those things clear, faint, distant, breathy, all at the same time. "We're flying," she said. "A trifle," called Arthur. "Think nothing of it. Try a swoop." "A swoop?" Her hand caught his, and in a second her weight caught it too, and stunningly she was gone, tumbling beneath him, clawing wildly at nothing. Physics glanced at Arthur, and clotted with horror, he was gone too, sick with giddy dropping, every part of him screaming but his voice. They plummeted because this was London, and you really couldn't do this sort of thing here. He couldn't catch her because this was London, and not a million miles from here, 756 to be exact, in Pisa, Galileo had clearly demonstrated that two falling bodies fell at exactly the same rate of acceleration, irrespective of their relative weights. They fell. Arthur realised as he fell, giddily and sickeningly, that if he was going to hang around in the sky believing everything that the Italians had to say about physics when they couldn't even keep a simple tower straight, that they were in dead trouble, and damn well did fall faster than Fenchurch. He grappled her from above and fumbled for a tight grip on her shoulders. He got it. Fine. They were now falling together, which was all very sweet and romantic, but didn't solve the basic problem, which was that they were falling and the ground wasn't waiting around to see if he had any more clever tricks up his sleeve, but was coming up to meet them like an express train. He couldn't support her weight. He hadn't anything he could support it with or against. The only thing he could think was that they were obviously going to die, and if he wanted anything other than the obvious to happen, he was going to have to do something other than the obvious. Here he felt he was on familiar territory. He let go of her, pushed her away, and when she turned her face to him in a gasp of stunned horror, caught her little finger with his little finger and swung her back upwards, tumbling clumsily up after her. "Shit," she said, as she sat panting and breathless on absolutely nothing at all. And when she'd recovered herself, they fled on up into the night. Just below cloud level, they paused and scanned where they had impossibly come. The ground was something not to regard with any too firm or steady an eye, but merely to glance at, as it were, in passing. Fenchurch tried some little swoops, daringly, and found that if she judged herself just right against a body of wind, she could pull off some really quite dazzling ones, with a little pirouette at the end, followed by a little drop which made her dress billow around her. And this is where readers who are keen to know what Marvin and Ford Prefect have been up to all this while should look ahead to later chapters, because Arthur could wait no longer and helped her take it off. It drifted down and away, whipped by the wind until it was a speck which finally vanished, and for various complicated reasons revolutionised the life of a family in Hounslow, over whose washing line it was discovered draped in the morning. In a mute embrace, they drifted up till they were swimming amongst the misty wraiths of moisture that you can see feathering around the wings of an aeroplane, but never feel because you are sitting warm inside the stuffy aeroplane, and looking through the little scratchy Perspex window while somebody else's son tries patiently to pour warm milk into your shirt. Arthur and Fenchurch could feel them, wispy, cold and thin, wreathing round their bodies, very cold, very thin. They felt, even Fenchurch, now protected from the elements by only a couple of fragments from Marks and Spencer, that if they were not going to let the force of gravity bother them, then mere cold or paucity of atmosphere could go and whistle. The two fragments from Marks and Spencer, which is Fenchurch, rose now into the misty body of the clouds, Arthur removed very, very slowly, which is the only way it's possible to do when you're flying and also not using your hands, went on to create considerable havoc in the morning in, respectively, counting from top to bottom, Isleworth and Richmond. They were in the cloud for a long time, because it was stacked very high, and when finally they emerged wetly above it, Fenchurch slowly spinning like a starfish lapped by a rising tide pool, they found that above the clouds is where the night gets seriously moonlit. The light is darkly brilliant. There are different mountains up there, but they are mountains with their own white Arctic snows. They had emerged at the top of the high-stacked cumulonimbus, and now began lazily to drift down its contours, as Fenchurch eased Arthur in turn from his clothes, prized him free of them till all were gone, winding their surprised way down into the enveloping whiteness. She kissed him, kissed his neck, his chest, and soon they were drifting on, turning slowly in a kind of speechless T-shape, which might have caused even a forlornest fire dragon, had one flown past replete with pizza, to flap its wings and cough a little. There were, however, no forlornest fire dragons in the clouds, nor could there be, for, like the dinosaurs, the dodos, and the greater drubbered wintwock of Stegbartel Major in the constellation Fraz, and unlike the Boeing 747, which is in plentiful supply, they are sadly extinct, and the universe shall never know their like again. The reason that a Boeing 747 crops up rather unexpectedly in the above list is not unconnected with the fact that something very similar happened in the lives of Arthur and Fenchurch a moment or two later. They are big things, terrifyingly big. You know when one is in the air with you. There is a thunderous attack of air, a moving wall of screaming wind, and you get tossed aside if you are foolish enough to be doing anything remotely like what Arthur and Fenchurch were doing in its close vicinity, like butterflies in the Blitz. This time, however, there was a heart-sickening fall or loss of nerve, a regrouping moments later, and a wonderful new idea enthusiastically signalled through the buffeting noise. Mrs. E. Capelson of Boston, Massachusetts, was an elderly lady. Indeed, she felt her life was nearly at an end. She had seen a lot of it, been puzzled by some, but she was a little uneasy to feel at this late stage, bored by too much. It had all been very pleasant, but perhaps a little too explicable, a little too routine. With a sigh, she flipped up the little plastic window shutter and looked out over the wing. At first she thought she ought to call the stewardess, but then she thought, no, damn it, definitely not. This was for her, and her alone. By the time her two inexplicable people finally slipped back off the wing and tumbled into the slipstream, she had cheered up an awful lot. She was mostly immensely relieved to think that virtually everything that anybody had ever told her was wrong. The following morning, Arthur and Fenchurch slept very late in the alley, despite the continual wail of furniture being restored. The following night, they did it all over again, only this time with Sony Walkman. Chapter 27. "This is all very wonderful," said Fenchurch a few days later, "but I do need to know what's happened to me. You see, there's this difference between us, that you lost something and found it again, and I found something and lost it. I need to find it again." She had to go out for the day, so Arthur settled down for a day of telephoning. Murray Bost Henson was a journalist on one of the papers of small pages and big print. It would be pleasant to be able to say he was none the worse for this, but sadly this was not the case. He happened to be the only journalist that Arthur knew, so Arthur phoned him anyway. "Arthur, my old soup spoon, my old silver tureen, how particularly stunning to hear from you. Someone told me you'd gone off into space or something." Murray had his own special kind of conversation language, which he had invented for his own use, and which no one else was able to speak or even to follow. Hardly any of it meant anything at all. The bits which did mean anything were often so wonderfully buried that no one could ever spot them slipping past in the avalanche of nonsense. The time when he did find out later, which bits he did mean, was often a bad time for all concerned. What? Said Arthur.
Ah, just a rumour, my old elephant tusk, my little green baize card table, just a rumour. Probably means nothing at all, but I may need a quote from you.
Nothing to say, just pub talk, said Arthur.
We thrive on it, my old prosthetic limb, we thrive on it. Plus it would fit like a what's-it in one of those other things with the other stories of the week. So it could be enough just to have you denying it. Excuse me, something's just fallen out of my ear.
There was a slight pause, at the end of which Murray Boss Tennyson came back on the line, sounding genuinely shaken.
I just remembered, he said, what an odd evening I had last night. Anyway, my old, I won't say what, how do you feel about having ridden on Halley's Comet?
I haven't, said Arthur, with a suppressed sigh, ridden on Halley's Comet.
OK, how do you feel about not having ridden on Halley's Comet?
Pretty relaxed, Murray. There was a pause while Murray wrote this down.
Ah, good enough for me, Arthur, good enough for Ethel and me and the chickens. Fits in with the general weirdness of the week. Week of the Weirdos, we're thinking of calling it. Good, eh?
Very good.
Got a ring to it. First we have this man it always rains on.
What?
Ah, it's the absolute stocking top truth, all documented in his little black book. It all checks out at every single fun-loving level. The Met Office is going ice-cold thick banana whips, and funny little men in white coats are flying in from all over the world with their little rulers and boxes and drip feeds. This man is the bee's knees, Arthur. He is the wasp's nipples. He is, I would go so far as to say, the entire set of erogenous zones of every major flying insect of the Western world. We're calling him the rain god, and I say...
I think I've met him, said Arthur.
Good ring to it. What did you say?
I may have met him. Complains all the time, yes?
Incredible! You met the rain god?
Well, if it's the same guy, I told him to stop complaining and show someone his book. There was an impressed pause from Murray Boss Tennyson's end of the phone.
Well, you did a bundle. An absolute bundle has absolutely been done by you. Listen, do you know how much a tour operator is paying that guy not to go to Malaga this year? I mean, forget irrigating the Sahara and boring stuff like that. This guy has a whole new career ahead of him, just avoiding places for money. The man's turning into a monster, Arthur. We might even have to make him win the bingo. Listen, we may want to do a feature on you, Arthur, the man who made the rain god rain. Got a good ring to it, eh?
A nice one, but
we might need to photograph you under a garden shower, but that'll be okay. Where are you?
I'm in Islington. Listen, Murray.
Islington?
Yes.
Well, what about the real weirdness of the week? The real seriously loopy stuff? You know about these flying people?
No.
Oh, you must have. This is the really seethingly crazy one. This is the real meatballs in the batter. Locals are phoning in all the time to say there's this couple of go flying nights. We've got guys down in our photo labs working through the night to put together a genuine photograph. You must have heard.
No.
Arthur, where have you been? Oh, space, right, I got your quote. But that was months ago. Listen, it's night after night this week, my old cheese grater. Right on your patch, this couple just fly around the sky and start doing all kinds of stuff. And I don't mean looking through walls or pretending to be box-girded bridges. You know anything?
No.
Arthur, it's been almost inexpressibly delicious conversing with you, chum bum, but I have to go. I'll send the guy with the camera and the hose. Give me the address. I'm ready in writing.
Listen, Murray, I called to ask you something.
I have a lot to do.
I just wanted to find out something about the dolphins.
Ah, no story. Last year's news. Forget them. They're gone.
It's important.
Listen, no one will touch it. You can't sustain a story, you know, when the only news is the continuing absence of whatever it is the story's about. Not our territory, anyway. Try the Sundays. Maybe they'll run a little whatever happened to the dolphin story in a couple of years, around August. But what's anybody going to do now? Dolphins still gone? Continuing dolphin absence? Dolphins further days without them? The story dies, Arthur. It lies down and kicks its little feet in the air and presently goes to the great golden spike in the sky, my old fruit bat.
Murray, I'm not interested in whether it's a story. I just want to find out how I can get in touch with that guy in California who claims to know something about it. I thought you might know. Chapter 28. People are beginning to talk, said Fenchurch that evening, after they'd hauled her cello in. Not only talk, said Arthur, but print in big bold letters under the bingo prizes, which is why I thought I'd better get these. He showed her the long, narrow booklets of airline tickets.
Arthur, she said, hugging him, does that mean you've managed to talk to him?
I have had a day, said Arthur, of extreme telephonic exhaustion. I have spoken to virtually every department, to virtually every paper in Fleet Street, and I finally tracked his number down. You've obviously been working hard. You're drenched with sweat, poor darling.
Not with sweat, said Arthur wearily. A photographer's just been... I tried to argue, but never mind. The point is...
Yes.
You spoke to him?
I spoke to his wife. She said he was too weird to come to the phone right now and I should call back. He sat down heavily, realized he was missing something, and went to the fridge to find it. Want a drink? We'd commit murder to get one. I always know I'm in for a tough time when my cello teacher looks me up and down and says, "Oh, yes, my dear, I think a little Tchaikovsky today." "I called again," said Arthur, "and she said that he was 3.2 light-years from the phone, and I should call back." "Ah." "I called again. She said the situation had improved. He was now a mere 2.6 light-years from the phone, but it was still a long way to shout." "You don't suppose," said Fenchurch doubtfully, "that there's anyone else we can talk to?" "It gets worse," said Arthur. "I spoke to someone on the Science magazine who actually knows him, and he said that John Watson will not only believe, but will actually have absolute proof, often dictated to him by angels with golden beards and green wings and Dr. Skull footwear, that the month's most fashionable silly theory is true. For people who question the validity of these visions, he will triumphantly produce the clogs in question, and that's as far as you get." "Oh, I didn't realize it was that bad," said Fenchurch quietly. She fiddled listlessly with the tickets. "I phoned Mrs. Watson again," said Arthur. "Her name, by the way, and you may wish to know this, is Arcane Jill." "I see." "I'm glad you see. I thought you mightn't believe any of this, so when I called her this time, I used the telephone answering machine to record the call." He went across to the telephone machine and fiddled and fumed with all its buttons for a while, because it was the one that was particularly recommended by Witch magazine and is almost impossible to use without going mad. "Here it is," he said at last, wiping the sweat from his brow. The voice was thin and crackly with its journey to a geostationary satellite and back, but was also hauntingly calm. "Perhaps I should explain," Arcane Jill Watson's voice said, "that the phone is in fact in a room that he never comes into. It's in the asylum, you see. Wonka the Saiyan does not like to enter the asylum, and so he does not. I feel you should know this, because it may save you phoning. If you'd like to meet him, this is very easily arranged. All you have to do is walk in. He will only meet people outside the asylum." Arthur's voice, at its most mystified. I'm sorry, I don't understand. Where is the asylum?" "Where is the asylum?" Archangel Watson again. "Have you ever read the instructions on a packet of toothpicks?" On the tape, Arthur's voice had to admit that he had not. "You may want to do that. You may find that it clarifies things for you a little. You may find that it indicates to you where the asylum is. Thank you." The sound of the phone line went dead. Arthur turned the machine off. "Well, I suppose we regard that as an invitation," he said with a shrug. "I actually managed to get the address from the guy on the Science magazine." Fenchurch looked at him again with a thoughtful frown and looked at the tickets again. "Do you think it's worth it?" she said. "Well," said Arthur, "the one thing that everyone I spoke to agreed on, apart from the fact that they all thought he was barking mad, is that he does know more than any man living about dolphins." Chapter 29. "This is an important announcement. This is Flight 121 to Los Angeles. If your travel plans today do not include Los Angeles, now will be the perfect time to disembark." Chapter 30. They rented a car in Los Angeles from one of the places that rents out cars that other people have thrown away. "Getting it to go around corners is a bit of a problem," said the guy behind the sunglasses as he handed them the key. "Sometimes it's simpler just to get out and find a car that's going in that direction." They stayed for one night in a hotel on Sunset Boulevard, which someone had told them they would enjoy being puzzled by. Everyone there is either English or odd or both. They've got a swimming pool where you can go and watch English rock stars reading Language, Truth and Logic for the photographers. It was true. There was one, and that was exactly what he was doing. The garage attendant didn't think much of their car, but that was fine because they didn't either. Late in the evening, they drove through the Hollywood Hills along Mulholland Drive and stopped to look out first over the dazzling sea of floating light that is Los Angeles, and later stopped to look across the dazzling sea of floating light that is the San Fernando Valley. They agreed that the sense of dazzle stopped immediately at the back of their eyes and didn't touch any other part of them, and came away strangely unsatisfied by the spectacle. As dramatic seas of light went, it was fine, but light is meant to illuminate something, and having driven through what this particular dramatic sea of light was illuminating, they didn't think much of it. They slept late and restlessly, and awoke at lunchtime when it was stupidly hot. They drove out along the freeway to Santa Monica for their first look at the Pacific Ocean, the ocean which Wonka the Sane spent all his days and a good deal of his nights looking at. "Someone told me," said Fenchurch, "that they once overheard two old ladies on this beach doing what we're doing, looking at the Pacific Ocean for the first time in their lives, and apparently, after a long pause, one of them said to the other, "You know, it's not as big as I expected." Gradually, their mood lifted as they walked along the beach in Malibu and watched all the millionaires in their chic shanty huts, carefully keeping an eye on each other to check how rich they were each getting. Their mood lifted further as the sun began to move down the western half of the sky, and by the time they were back in their rattling car and driving towards a sunset that no one of any sensibility would dream of building a city like Los Angeles in front of, they were suddenly feeling astonishingly and irrationally happy, and didn't even mind that the terrible old car radio would only play two stations, and those simultaneously. So what, they were both playing good rock and roll. "I know that he'll be able to help us," said Fenchurch determinedly. "I know he will. What's his name again that he likes to be called?" "Wonko the Sane." "I know that he will be able to help us." Arthur wondered if he would, and hoped that he would, and hoped that what Fenchurch had lost could be found here, on this earth, whatever this earth might prove to be. He hoped, as he had hoped continually and fervently since the time they had talked together on the banks of the Serpentine, that he would not be called upon to try and remember something that he had very firmly and deliberately buried in the furthest recesses of his memory, where he hoped it would cease to nag at him. In Santa Barbara, they stopped at a fish restaurant in what seemed to be a converted warehouse. Fenchurch had red mullet and said it was delicious. Arthur had a swordfish steak and said it made him angry. He grabbed a passing waitress by the arm and berated her. "Why is this fish so bloody good?" he demanded angrily. "Please excuse my friend," said Fenchurch to the startled waitress. "I think he's having a nice day at last." Chapter 31. If you took a couple of David Bowies and stuck one of the David Bowies on top of the other David Bowie, and then attached another David Bowie to the end of each of the arms of the upper of the first two David Bowies, and wrapped the whole business up in a dirty beach robe, you would then have something which didn't exactly look like John Watson, but which those who knew him would find hauntingly familiar. He was tall and he gangled. When he sat in his deck chair, gazing at the Pacific, not so much with any kind of wild surmise any longer, as with a peaceful, deep dejection, it was a little difficult to tell exactly where the deck chair ended and he began. And you would hesitate to put your hand on, say, his forearm, in case the whole structure suddenly collapsed with a snap and took your thumb off. But his smile, when he turned it on you, was quite remarkable. It seemed to be composed of all the worst things that life can do to you, but which, when he briefly reassembled them in that particular order on his face, made you suddenly feel, "Oh, well, that's all right, then." When he spoke, you were glad that he used the smile that made you feel like that pretty often. "Oh, yes," he said, "they come and see me. They sit right here. They sit right here where you're sitting." He was talking of the angels with the golden beards and green wings and Dr. Skull's sandals. "They eat nachos, which they say they can't get where they come from. They do a lot of coke and are very wonderful about a whole range of things." "Do they?" said Arthur. "Are they? When is this, then? When do they come?" He gazed out at the Pacific as well. There were little sandpipers running along the margin of the shore, which seemed to have this problem. They needed to find their food in the sand which a wave had just washed over, but they couldn't bear to get their feet wet. To deal with this problem, they ran with an odd kind of movement, as if they'd been constructed by someone very clever in Switzerland. Fenchurch was sitting on the sand, idly drawing patterns in it with her fingers. "Weekends, mostly," said Wonko the Sane, "on little scooters. They are great machines." He smiled. "I see," said Arthur, "I see." A tiny cough from Fenchurch attracted his attention, and he looked round at her. She had scratched a little stick figure drawing in the sand of the two of them in the clouds. For a moment he thought she was trying to get him excited. Then he realized that she was rebuking him. "Who are we," she was saying, "to say that he's mad?" His house was certainly peculiar, and since this is the first thing that Fenchurch and Arthur had encountered, it would help to know what it was like. What it was like was this. It was inside out. Actually inside out, to the extent that they had to park on the carpet. All along what one would normally call the outer wall, which was decorated in a tasteful interior-designed pink, were bookshelves. Also a couple of those odd three-legged tables with semicircular tops, which stand in such a way as to suggest that someone had just dropped the wall straight through them. And pictures, which were clearly designed to soothe. Where it got really odd was the roof. It folded back on itself like something that Moritzi Escher, had he been given to hard nights on the town, which it is no part of this narrative's purpose to suggest was the case, but sometimes hard looking at his pictures, particularly the ones with all the awkward steps, not to wonder, might have dreamt up after having been on one. For the little chandeliers, which should have been hanging inside, were on the outside, pointing up. Confusing. The sign above the front door said, "Come outside," and so, nervously, they had. Inside, of course, was where the outside was. Rough brickwork, nicely done pointing, guttering in good repair, a garden path, a couple of small trees, some rooms leading off. And the inner walls stretched down, folded curiously, and opened at the end, as if, by an optical illusion that would have had Moritzi Escher frowning and wondering how it was done, to enclose the Pacific Ocean itself. "Hello," said John Watson, Wonko the Sane. "Good," they thought to themselves. "Hello is something we can cope with." "Hello," they said, and all surprisingly with smiles. For quite a while he seemed curiously reluctant to talk about the dolphins, looking oddly distracted and saying, "I forget," whenever they were mentioned, and had shown them quite proudly round the eccentricities of his house. "It gives me pleasure," he said, "in a curious kind of way, and does nobody any harm," he continued, "that a competent optician couldn't correct." They liked him. He had an open, engaging quality, and seemed able to mock himself before anybody else did. "Your wife," said Arthur, looking round, "mentioned some toothpicks?" He said it with a hunted look, as if he was worried that she might suddenly leap out from behind the door and mention them again. Wonko the Sane laughed. It was a light, easy laugh, and sounded like one he'd used a lot before and was happy with. "Ah, yes," he said, "that's to do with the day I finally realized that the world had gone totally mad, and I built the asylum to put it in, poor thing, and hoped it would get better." This is the point at which Arthur began to feel nervous again. "Here," said Wonko the Sane, "we are outside the asylum." He pointed again at the rough brickwork, the pointing and the guttering. "Go through that door." He pointed at the first door through which they'd originally entered, "and you go into the asylum. I tried to decorate it nicely to keep the inmates happy, but there's very little one can do. I never go in there now myself. If ever I am tempted, which these days I rarely am, I simply look at the sign written over the door and I shy away." "That one," said Fenchurch, pointing rather puzzled at a blue plaque with some instructions written on it. "Yes, they are the words that finally turned me into the hermit I have now become. It was quite sudden. I saw them, and I knew what I had to do." The sign said, "Hold stick near centre of its length. Moisten pointed end in mouth. Insert in tooth space, blunt end next gum. Use gentle in-out motion." "It seemed to me," said Wonko the Sane, "that any civilization that had so far lost its head as to need to include a set of detailed instructions for use in a packet of toothpicks was no longer a civilization in which I could live and stay sane." He gazed out at the Pacific again, as if daring it to rave and gibber at him, but it lay there calmly and played with the sandpipers. "And in case it crossed your mind to wonder, as I can see how it possibly might, I am completely sane, which is why I call myself Wonko the Sane, just to reassure people on this point. Wonko is what my mother called me when I was a kid and clumsy and knocked things over, and sane is what I am, and how," he added with one of his smiles that made you feel, "Oh, well, that's all right then, I intend to remain. Shall we go on to the beach and see what we have to talk about?" They went out onto the beach, which was where he started talking about angels with golden beards and green wings and Dr. Skull sandals. "About the dolphins," said Fenchurch gently, hopefully. "I can show you the sandals," said Wonko the Sane. "I wonder, do you know..." "Would you like me to show you?" said Wonko the Sane. "The sandals, I have them, I'll get them. They are made by the Dr. Skull Company, and the angels say they particularly suit the terrain they have to work in. They say they run a concession stand by the message. When I say I don't know what that means, they say, 'No, you don't,' and laugh. Well, I'll get them anyway." As he walked back towards the inside, or the outside, depending on how you looked at it, Arthur and Fenchurch looked at each other in a wondering and slightly desperate sort of way. Then each shrugged and idly drew figures in the sand. "How are the feet today?" said Arthur quietly. "Okay, it doesn't feel so odd in the sand, or in the water. The water touches them perfectly. I just think this isn't our world." She shrugged. "What do you think he meant," she said, "by the message?" "I don't know," said Arthur, though the memory of a man called Prack, who laughed at him continuously, kept nagging at him. When Wonka returned, he was carrying something that stunned Arthur. Not the sandals, they were perfectly ordinary wooden-bottomed sandals. "I just thought you'd like to see," he said, "what angels wear on their feet." "Just out of curiosity. I'm not trying to prove anything, by the way. I'm a scientist and I know what constitutes proof. But the reason I call myself by my childhood name is to remind myself that a scientist must be absolutely like a child. If he sees a thing, he must say that he sees it, whether it was what he thought he was going to see or not. See first, think later, then test. But always see first, otherwise you'll only see what you were expecting. Most scientists forget that. I'll show you something to demonstrate that later. So the other reason I call myself Wonko the Sane is so that people will think that I'm a fool. That allows me to see what I see when I see it. You can't possibly be a scientist if you mind people thinking that you're a fool. Anyway, I also thought you might like to see this." This was the thing that Arthur had been stunned to see him carrying, for it was a wonderful silver-grey glass fishbowl, seemingly identical to the one in Arthur's bedroom. Arthur had been trying for some 30 seconds now, without success, to say, "Where did you get that?" sharply, and with a gasp in his voice. Finally his time had come, but he missed it by a millisecond. "Where did you get that?" said Fenchurch, sharply, and with a gasp in her voice. Arthur glanced at Fenchurch sharply, and with a gasp in his voice said, "What, have you seen one of these before?" "Yes," she said, "I've got one, or at least did have. Russell nicked it to put his golf balls in. I don't know where it came from, just that I was angry with Russell for nicking it. Why, have you got one?" "Yes, it was..." They both became aware that Wonko the Sane was glancing sharply backwards and forwards between them and trying to get a gasp in edgeways. "You have one of these too?" he said to both of them. "Yes," they both said it. He looked long and calmly at each of them. Then he held up the bowl to catch the light of the Californian sun. The bowl seemed almost to sing with the sun, to chime with the intensity of its light, and cast darkly brilliant rainbows around the sand and upon them. He turned it and turned it. They could see quite clearly in the fine tracery of its etchwork the words, "So long, and thanks for all the fish." "Do you know," said Wonka quietly, "what it is?" They each shook their heads slowly and with wonder, almost hypnotized by the flashing of the lightning shadows in the grey glass. "It is a farewell gift from the dolphins," said Wonka in a low, quiet voice. "The dolphins whom I loved and studied and swam with and fed with fish, and even tried to learn their language, a task which they seemed to make impossibly difficult, considering the fact that I now realize they were perfectly capable of communicating in ours if they decided they wanted to." He shook his head with a slow, slow smile, and then looked again at Fenchurch, and then at Arthur. "Have you?" he said to Arthur. "What have you done with yours, may I ask you that?"
I keep a fish in it," said Arthur, slightly embarrassed. "I happened to have this fish I was wondering what to do with, and there was this bowl." He tailed off.
"You've done nothing else?"
"No," he said. "If you had, you would know."
He shook his head again.
"My wife kept wheat germ in ours," resumed Wonko, with some new tone in his voice, "until last night."
"What," said Arthur slowly and hushedly, "happened last night?"
"We ran out of wheat germ," said Wonko evenly. "And my wife," he added, "has gone to get some more."
He seemed lost in his own thoughts for a moment.
"And what happened then?" said Fenchurch in the same breathless tone.
"I washed it," said Wonka. "I washed it very carefully, very, very carefully, removing every last speck of wheat germ. Then I dried it slowly with the lint-free cloth,
slowly, carefully, turning it over and over. Then I held it to my ear. Have you? Have you held one to your ear? They both shook their heads, again slowly, again dumbly. Perhaps, he said, you should. End of side 7.